Very good point. And of course, any discussion about risk of abuse does lead into a discussion about do you use springing versus durable powers of attorney. So whether you use a power of attorney that goes into effect immediately or one that goes into effect only upon the principal's incapacity. So you know, I don't recommend springing powers of attorney. Two primary reasons. First, the process for determining incapacity and demonstrating that incapacity can be really cumbersome and unnecessarily delay payment of bills and other financial matters if the power of attorney is actually needed. And the second reason is if the principal does not trust the agent with authority while the principal has capacity and could presumably discover, mitigate wrongdoing, the principal definitely should not be granting that agent authority upon incapacity. So we've also talked a bit about this and why a principal might be hesitant to grant this immediate authority and be tempted by the idea of a springing power of attorney. How do you tend to have that conversation with your clients?
I try to really examine why they are hesitant and figure out if they are comfortable with the person being named, which can open up a whole host of other conversations to be had. But I really try to explain the importance of trying to avoid a guardianship proceeding and that it's sometimes contested, costly, time-consuming, and that this is a very useful document to have when dealing with incapacity. Regarding springing powers, I go back to the fiduciary duties that come associated with it, and that I say that I generally like to see a durable power of attorney. I also think that the process for determining incapacity is time-consuming and cumbersome, and it's getting harder and harder to find a physician willing to certify incapacity, much less if the document requires more than one physician to certify. And practically speaking, the client will need immediate use of this document, and they don't want to wait around for the doctor certification. And so with that being said, let's go into a discussion of the medical power of attorney. So a medical power of attorney allows the principal to designate an agent to make his or her medical decisions in the event the principal is unable to communicate. Unlike the durable power of attorney we just discussed, which is effective upon signing, a medical power of attorney only becomes effective during the times that the principal is unable to make his or her own healthcare decisions. The medical power of attorney must be in substantially the form provided in the Texas Health and Safety Code. I'm going to say that one more time because it's so important. The medical power of attorney must be in substantially the form provided in the Texas Health and Safety Code. Unlike modifications that we just discussed regarding the durable power of attorney, a medical power of attorney should not and cannot deviate significantly from the statutory form. There's no clear guidelines as to the type or the degree of modification permitted, so therefore you should exercise caution in modifying the form in any manner. The form is now allowed to be either notarized, which I love, or signed in the presence of two witnesses. Subject to any limitations imposed in the medical power of attorney, the agent who is authorized to act under that medical power of attorney has the legal right to obtain the principal's medical information. However, practically speaking, it's nice to have an expressed HIPAA authorization, which we'll talk about a little bit later, which can be combined within that medical power of attorney or used as a separate document. The separate HIPAA authorization can make assessing information easier for that agent, as medical personnel are familiar with that and they don't need to question whether the agent is presently authorized to act. I think it is interesting to note that the revocation of this document can be done orally or in writing and without regard to the principal's mental state or competency. So I think that could make for some really fun fact scenarios, none of which I have ever seen play out. But it is interesting that there's no regard to the principal's mental state or capacity to revoke. So Tanya, how do you counsel clients who want to name co-agents in this document, and what are their risks in doing so?
Yeah, so this goes back to the substantial compliance issue that you mentioned. The statutory form is designed to allow the appointment of successor agents. And of course, it's a very good idea to have at least one or two successor agents named, but it's not really designed to allow for joint agents. Or there's no explicit statutory prohibition on the appointment of joint agents. So some practitioners are comfortable modifying the form to do that. If a client approaches me and wishes to appoint co-agents, I normally suggest that we instead name them sequentially, but name both of them in a general HIPAA authorization so that both the primary and successor are equally authorized to speak to medical providers. Similarly, in the special request section of the medical power of attorney, I might add a precatory request that both people coordinate with each other in making decisions. You just do want to make sure that that special request is clearly precatory. And all that being said, I have occasionally drafted medical powers of attorney that appointed joint agents. I've done it about 3 to 4 times probably over the past 10 years. And it's just incredibly important that the client understands the risk that it could be invalid or questioned by medical professionals. And it's really important that you, as the drafting attorney, properly document that you have explained this risk to the client. And I think that actually brings us to the directive to physicians, which is the document that addresses end-of-life care. It allows the client to leave instructions regarding the use of life-sustaining measures in the event he or she suffers from a terminal or irreversible condition from which he is not expected to recover any decision-making capacity, even with all available medical intervention. The Texas Health and Safety Code does provide a form for the directive to physicians. The statutory form is not exclusive, meaning other forms can be used. But it is generally a good idea to follow the statutory form reasonably closely if possible, because its format and guidelines are going to be familiar to medical personnel. So one question I get a lot is, do I need a directive? I would say if you know that you do or do not want life support in these conditions, the directive is a really good idea. And it is a kind thing to do for your agent because it takes the burden of making the decision off the agent's shoulders. However, if you really aren't sure what you would want in these circumstances, it is okay to leave the decision up to the agent in the medical power of attorney.